The evidence seems to indicate to me anyway that Argentina does in fact enjoy a superior historical claim to the Malvinas. Many times, though, this is balanced by the British claim derived primarily from the principle of self-determination. If the islanders, if the people who are living on the Falkland Islands are a self, and if they're able to determine what they want to have as their principal association, they clearly want to associate themselves with Great Britain and not with Argentina. And so self-determination, which has certainly been one of the leading international principles of the last couple of centuries, if this principle is applied here, it would seem as though the case is fairly well settled. The few thousand people who live there want to have the islands under British control. They've lived there now for a very long time, and it's time just to get on with it and have the matter settled. Now, arguments for or against applying the principle of self-determination in this or in any other instances have often been analyzed best by the British, a number of whom have argued that there really are no very terribly clear definitions of the principle of self-determination, much less that even if the were an agreed upon definition, that it should be applied as an absolute principle. In fact, many have noted that the principle very often seems to be a rather utopian one, unless it is tempered by some more pragmatic considerations. Sir Ivor Jennings wrote in 1956 that Woodrow Wilson's famous principle of self-determination, such as he understood it during and after the First World War, was ridiculous, but somehow it was widely accepted as a sensible proposition. He said, "On the surface, it seemed reasonable. Let the people decide. It is in fact ridiculous because the people cannot decide unless somebody decides who are the people. This matter of defining the self has in fact been one of the primary problems with the principle of self-determination for the last couple of hundred years. Defining what a self should determine and how it should determine that are the next problems. Now, a common person might think that the self in the principle of self-determination is a person, is an individual, and that determination is that person's implementation of personal choices of political association and party affiliation, religion, ideology, occupation, and so on. And that with this understanding, self-determination is very much related to the idea of republican government. And the principle within the principle of self-determination applied within a country would mean having republican government, republican with a small r, that is, mixed government which protects the rights of individuals to make choices about all kinds of different matters. So the self is about selves, and the selves are individuals. But of course, the principle of self-determination usually has another adjective sitting in front of it. It's not just of the principle of individual self-determination. Very often, it is the principle of national self-determination, that we're not just talking about individuals here who are making choices about what they would like to do about this, that, or the other thing. We're talking about nations, about relatively large groups of people, and that the principle is a principle of national self-determination. Well, now already we've had three interpretations of selves. The first one we sort of considered was the common sense view in the case of the Falkland Islands, is that the self involved would be those who live on the islands, the kelpers, as they're referred to. There's a lot of kelp that grows around in the islands, and so the Falkland Islanders are often referred to as kelpers. So the kelpers, the Falkland Islanders, the Falklanders, they are the self. What are their wishes? They are a defined group of people living in this territory, and there you go. This common sense of self is that, well, selves are individuals, and it's not every individual. We're talking about the group of Falkland Islanders. But if we're talking about the principle of national self-determination, well, then we're talking about a nation. And no one is saying that the Falkland Islands are a nation, because traditionally the principle of national self-determination is that every nation should have its own territorial state, which is sovereign. That the ideal would be a system in which every nation, defined by language and culture and religion and common purposes and outlook and all that sort of thing, that there is an English people, there's a French people, there's a German people, there's a this, that, and the other kind of people, and that each one of them really ought to have their own sovereign territory to live in, and that if they did, then everybody would be quite satisfied. An opinion often attributed to Woodrow Wilson and many others. And so that the principle of national self-determination is very much linked to nations, to groups of people enjoying national sovereignty. Well, if we're talking about national sovereignty, or the principle of national self-determination, then we're talking about all British citizens trying to define for themselves as best as they can as to what territory should be part of the British Commonwealth or of Great Britain, even. And this has been, of course, an agonizing question in any number of circumstances for a rather long time. But it would be up to the British people to decide what specific pieces of territory should be under its de facto control, that perhaps it would be necessary. Now, in the past, this was a matter for kings to decide. They would get together and send their diplomats back and forth, and territory would be transferred back and forth, sort of irrespective of the wishes of the people. Those days are long gone, and now it's generally thought that the national electorate ought to be involved in these types of questions, but it wouldn't just be for the people of the Falkland Islands to make that decision. It would be for all of the British people, who might decide that it's not necessarily in their interest to keep control of this territory, or maybe it is, but it wouldn't be the Kelpers, it would be all of the British. So is the self the Kelpers, the Falklanders, or is the self all citizens of Great Britain? And of course, Britain has a very democratic government with lots of citizen input. And in this regard, the British state, the British government, represents the will of the British people. And if the British government negotiates a compromise with Argentina, that would be an expression of the will of the British self, and that has in fact led to negotiations over the past a few decades between Britain and Argentina about the future of the islands, which had an awful lot of the topics on the table. Okay, so does the principle of self-determination mean that the Kelpers, that the Falklanders by themselves should be able to figure out exactly what they want for their political association and make sure that those desires are respected by everyone else involved? Does the principle apply to the nation? And in this case, that would apply to Great Britain, although The Scots and the others maybe have a different view of nationality, but to outsiders, it looks like Great Britain is something of a nation. And so national self-determination would be for all of the British people, as represented by their democratic government, would understand that to be, and that as a reasonable body, they would include that principle along with many other principles and practical concerns to make their best judgments as to what serves the interests of all of Great Britain. Is that what is at stake? So you've got some competing issues, and in that sense, then diplomats can get involved, which makes some fervent nationalists a little nervous, because they might be far more pragmatic than some nationalists would want. But you have some of the arguments about what self-determination means. Now you have another important mix adding to this mix, and that is, in addition to self-determination, the issue of decolonization or anti-colonialism. When the United Nations was founded right after the Second World War, the majority of powers were those of the so-called West, of Western Europe and North America, allies in South America, and so on. As time goes on, and you have more and more Asian and African nations joining the United Nations, you start to have a change in sentiments about what is what's an important principle. As we had mentioned before, this you start off in the United Nations with the attitude that the territorial boundaries are where we begin, that we have to accept how they have been drawn in the past, and this comes up out of the experience out of the world wars, that you had a territorial dispute in the Balkans and the assassination carried out by a 19-year-old, and all of a sudden we're bogged down in a 4-year war leading to some 11 million casualties. And so the attitudes become pretty well established from the European experience that we've got to accept these boundaries. When the Germans violate the Polish and the Czech boundaries early on, this leads to a Second World War. We have to get that principle established as a sacrosanct one of respecting established boundaries and not trying to adjust them, not trying to solve international disputes with the first use of force, because it's that first use that can be the spark in the powder keg that can be so ultimately devastating. And in the nuclear era, a spark would be even worse than the previous two ones, and the fear of a third world war wasn't much more intense than even the memories of the first two terrible wars. Now, the Africans and Asians were most unimpressed with this. This seemed to be a very self-serving approach that was a status quo approach in favor of the colonial powers. They had gone around conquering the world. They said that this gave them a legal title to this territory, and they said that changing those territorial boundaries, especially through the use of force, would be too dangerous to world peace and could lead to a world conflagration, and hence just wouldn't be acceptable. None of that was well received by those who wished to throw off the shackles of colonialism. In fact, they were unimpressed with the notion. They didn't think the Third World War would break out just because some freedom fighters somewhere were struggling to throw off the shackles of the colonial powers and the policies that they had followed for throughout the imperialistic periods. And so the General Assembly finally comes to some agreement on this, and in 1960 passes the Resolution 1514, or the Declaration on the Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples. The people who had voted, the states that had voted in favor of this resolution, felt that it was colonialism that had prevented international economic cooperation, economic development, universal peace, that armed action directed against dependent peoples and for the maintenance of colonialism was clearly the unjust use of force. The process of liberation from colonialism was irresistible and irreversible. Only some rear guard and doomed reaction by metropolitan countries in the West could threaten to make the path from colonialism to sovereign statehood a rocky one. That the peoples living in former colonies clearly wished to gain their independence, and that it clearly was the will of these peoples to achieve their independent statehood and to become free peoples. And so the principle of self-determination became inherently associated with the principle of decolonization. And as the resolution mentioned, self-determination meant the end of colonialism in all of its manifestations. One could not imagine the peoples in a colonized area somehow preferring to remain under the tutelage of the Europeans. Unthinkable. They were inherently struggling for their freedom, and so self-determination meant throwing off the old colonial shackles. The two had become virtually merged. And the merging of self-determination with decolonization created a new just war doctrine. The United Nations had been formed on saying that you should not settle international disputes through the first use of force, that other mechanisms for dispute resolution had to be created and accepted, but that the first use of force was not one that could be. In this new version, there was a legitimate first use of force, and that was for the sake of achieving anti-colonial self-determination, that the Western imperial powers clearly had not shown themselves voluntarily willing to give up their possessions, that they had to very often be forced to give them up, and that it was sometimes up to anti-colonial groups to use force for that purpose, and that you could not expect this to lead to a third world war. Even the imperialist countries weren't crazy enough to do that. That old appeal fell on deaf ears, and that perhaps the first use of force for the sake of achieving anti-colonial self-determination was not aggression. And in fact, it wasn't even the first use of force. The first use of force, perhaps, was by the colonialists some centuries before, who had used force to take these territories, and that they had institutionalized their forcible control of them throughout the colonial period. And in that sense, the anti-colonialist use of force was not the first use of force, but was a defensive measure. Well, that was stretching the rules far beyond what they had come to mean in most people's minds, that after centuries of occupation, that finally this is not responding, this is not a defensive measure. Well, these were not just academic debates. It came about in a specific case right after the passage of 1514, when India, in December of 1961, invaded Portuguese Goa. The Portuguese had had a presence in Goa for 450 years. They had been there and continually throughout this period of time. By 1960, the Portuguese weren't threatening anyone. They they were pretty peacefully and profitably occupied within their territories and just intended to be left alone if they could be. For India, this was unacceptable. Now, from the Portuguese point of view, or from traditional thinking in the United Nations, the idea was, okay, the Portuguese maybe had used force in the early colonial period to get themselves established, but now this was long gone, and since the creation of the United Nations, maybe we could take things to the international court, but in the meantime, we'll just leave it the way it is. But India was not about to do that, and they said that you had the institutionalized first use of force in Portuguese Goa, and that India was going to be exercising self-defense, and that their attack on Goa was not an act of aggression, just because it looked to everybody else that after centuries, this, relatively speaking, this was the first use of force. The founders of the United Nations had argued that historical aggression did not justify modern aggression, because in the more integrated world, especially now of the nuclear age, war tended to spread and or escalate. International law's protection of Portugal's right was not based on the desire to protect an unjust status quo, but to prevent more inclusive, more frequent, or more destructive wars growing from a comparatively minor act of aggression. Given its dangers now in the 20th century, war was to be avoided irrespective of the merits of a dispute. The complicated tangle of disputes in the Balkans had led to the First World War, and Hitler's European invasions had brought the entire world into World War II, as we've mentioned. Local aggression could not be allowed to bring the world into a cataclysmic World War III. And so it was in this line of reasoning that the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, protested the Indian invasion. Resolution 1514, he argued, does not authorize the use of force for its implementation. It does not, and it should not, and it cannot under the Charter. Resolution 1514 does not and cannot overrule the Charter injunctions against the use of armed force. This was the kind of traditional opinion, and Stevenson expressed it well. Now, the majority of the Security Council agreed with Stevenson, but it did not pass a call for the ceasefire or for the withdrawal of Indian forces because of a Soviet veto. Now, the majority of the General Assembly, in which the African and Asians and so on held a majority of votes by this point, agreed with India that the argument against India's invasion was superfluous because it could not be reconciled with the new higher law of anti-colonial self-determination. The point was not that the Goans, the people who were living in Goa, did not want to become integrated with India. That, in fact, was largely irrelevant. The point was that it was only with an Indian invasion that the Portuguese would ever be pushed out of Goa, and that this colony would finally achieve its independence from European colonization. When Argentina invaded the Falkland Islands in 1982, its foreign minister, Costa Mendes, said that this was a situation identical, absolutely identical, he said in the United Nations, to that of 22 years before in the case of Goa, when Portugal was hanging on to its colonial power. The resolution that Portugal proposed had sought to deny India its territorial rights, according to Costa Mendes. And the citing of the Goan precedent won Panama support for the Argentines. The Panamanian ambassador to the United Nations argued that, quote, in 1961 in Asia, in the face of an unreal and absurd aspiration to maintain a Portuguese colonial empire, India, too, its patience exhausted by its years-long search for a solution to that problem, exercised its sovereign rights in the territory of Goa. In that case, India, too, received support and respect from Latin American public opinion. The justification that India gave for the invasion was not that Goa had been part of colonial India and had been wrested from India by Portugal, but that it had belonged to India before India's colonial days, and that Portugal's military occupation in 1510 had not conferred good title to Portugal even by 1960. Portugal's continuous presence in Goa for 450 years constituted an act of so-called permanent aggression, against which, under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, India had the right of self-defense. This was clearly a revisionist interpretation of what Article 51 had meant to anybody else before the principle of decolonization had gotten linked to self-determination in justifying a new just war doctrine. Just a few years after the Indian invasion of Goa, which turned out to be successful from an Indian point of view, you had, in 1965, the General Assembly passing Resolution 2065. And that resolution declared this, quote, Resolution 1514 of 14th December 1960 was prompted by the cherished aim of bringing to an end everywhere colonialism in all of its forms, one of which covers the case of the Falkland Islands, parentheses, Malvinas. It noted the dispute over sovereignty and invited the disputants to proceed with negotiations, quote, bearing in mind the provisions and objectives of the Charter of the United Nations and of the General Assembly Resolution 1514 and the interests of the population of the Falkland Islands, parentheses, Malvinas, the population, not the people. The resolution had not identified the Falkland Islanders as a self, as a people enjoying the right of self-determination. Instead, the people in this case were the Argentines. The principle of national self-determination linked to decolonization meant that the self in this case were not the people living on the islands, it was the people living in Argentina. They were the ones whose will was to be expressed in this case. All of this was very pressing in the 1960s, when Europe, the former European imperial powers, were gradually releasing their control of African and Asian colonies. This process was largely completed by the mid-1970s. By that point, the newly independent nations of these areas started to deal with the problems of governance rather than with the problems of gaining independence. The borders that had been drawn, usually by European powers, maybe originally had made little sense. The Congress of Berlin in 1886, the participants there brought out a map of Africa and they got their rulers and they drew nice straight lines all over the map, which had the tendency to either divide tribes or peoples and put the same group into different colonies, or they would unite groups which had historically sometimes been antagonistic to each other. When the new African nations became independent, like Latin America, they practiced a version of what Latin America called the principle of unipositatis, that the territorial boundaries of the former colonies now would become the territorial boundaries of the newly independent states, meaning that the states inherited all of those tangled tribal issues of different groups of being put together in the same nation, or the same one being separated into different nations, and so very often the African newly independent countries had to struggle with that question, and that created a good deal of instability. The old value of anti-colonialism was certainly still rhetorically important, and they had lots of fond feelings towards anti-colonialism. But the pressing political matters, starting as early as the mid-1970s, certainly by the early 1980s, was a need for stability. And a desire for avoiding destabilizing movements that could lead to any number of complications. And so the fact of the matter was that Argentina gained much less support from Africa and Asia than it might have otherwise expected by the time it invaded in 1982. At that point, the Africans, again, were interested more in stability than the old rhetoric about anti-colonialism would have implied. And they saw any first use of force to settle territorial disputes as exactly the type of thing that could create so many problems in their own situations. And so the linking of anti-colonialism with self-determination was a moment that had passed by. And when Argentina finally thought, as Costa Mendez mentioned, that it could apply that in 1982, it was doing so past the prime of that movement, and really no longer did the world accept the notion that self-determination meant that the Argentines could use force first to regain control of territory that had been conquered 150 years before.